Pop culture is caught in a time loop. We're living in an era where Spotify streams music history on demand, Hollywood churns out endless reboots, and yesterday's trends return with alarming speed. This obsession with our cultural past isn't just nostalgia. It may signal a fundamental crisis in creativity. Are we looking backward because we've run out of ways to move forward? Or has our constant recycling of the past actually prevented new forms from emerging? This paradox sits at the heart of Retromania, where music critic Simon Reynolds examines how our relationship with cultural history has fundamentally changed. The 2000s weren't defined by innovation, but by an unprecedented wave of recycling. Band reunions, reissues, remakes, and retro styling dominated entertainment. Most troublingly, the interval between something happening and being revisited shrank dramatically, creating a peculiar temporal loop where events were being commemorated almost simultaneously with their occurrence. There's something profoundly contradictory about putting rock music in a museum. Rock's ephemeral, disruptive energy fundamentally clashes with the preservationist ethos of institutions. Yet we've transformed even punk's insurrectionary power into lifeless artifacts behind glass. The rebellious energy that made rock meaningful has been neutralized, transformed into respectable history. This cultural preservation extends beyond museums to the stage, where aging bands perform classic albums in their entirety, a trend that represents both rebellion against digital music culture and lucrative nostalgia. We've become digital hoarders, saving everything indiscriminately. Our culture suffers from what Reynolds calls Chris Farley syndrome, empty nostalgia spread through YouTube's chaotic amateur cultural salvage. What matters isn't just total recall, but instant access that eliminates delays once required by physical archives. Today's teenagers can immediately view 1960s Beatles concerts, 1980s MTV videos, or yesterday's viral content. This constant availability flattens historical perspective, with all eras existing simultaneously in an eternal digital present. I've amassed an enormous private audio archive despite never identifying as a collector, a term I associated with those prioritizing format over music itself. Reality struck when I noticed vinyl filling every room, with more recordings in basement lockers and overseas storage. My collection now creates a subliminal pressure. Will I have enough time to listen to everything I like once more? This represents the music obsessive's midlife crisis, where potential pleasures become reminders of mortality. Psychoanalysts suggest collecting wards off death anxiety, yet eventually possessions remind us of inevitable loss. The internet and MP3 culture have both amplified and undermined secret musical knowledge, allowing anyone to amass vast collections without previous constraints of space or income. The term curated by infiltrated music's left-field fringes in the early 2000s, elevating compilation selection with art world prestige. Modern musicians increasingly function as self-portraits of artists as consumers, sourcing their sonic identity from record shops, flea markets, and digital archives. As music became self-referential, creativity reduced to taste games, with bands assembling identities within an economy of influences, speculating in pasts rather than futures. Record collectors act as explorers and renegade historians, bringing back weird treasures while redrawing pop history's map. This curatorial impulse has led musician collectors to become reissuers and compilers, even retroactively creating genres that never existed as recognized entities. When was the last time you heard a truly new sound in popular music? More likely, you've encountered clever recombinations, 70s funk with 90s hip-hop beats and 80s synthesizers. We've become so skilled at recycling our musical past that we've forgotten how to create a musical future. For veteran artists, reunions offer creative rejuvenation, but primarily financial windfalls. Most eventually become tribute bands to themselves, while the memorability market transforms rebellion into commodity, where items gain value precisely when they lose their original utility. Japan embodies musical archiving and curation so thoroughly that Roland Barthes' Empire of Signs could be called the Empire of Retro. Japanese musicians excel at mimesis, from eleki, shadow-style rock, to group sounds, British beat imitations, to 1970s freak bands with Western models. What's remarkable isn't any wrongness in these imitations, but their meticulous attention to stylistic detail, often surpassing their inspirations in precision. This approach reflects traditional Japanese artistic values that prioritize mastery within tradition over originality, similar to apprentice painters learning by copying masters. This curatorial sensibility connected Japanese hipsters with their global counterparts. This hipster international, young creatives in media, fashion, design, and aesthetic industries, exists in any affluent city with a substantial upper middle class. From Sao Paulo to London, Berlin to Brooklyn, these rootless cosmopolitans share more with each other than with their physical neighbors, forming a global class united by obsessive knowledge of obscure music and cultural history. The collector dynamic evolved from, "I want something no one else has," to, "I've found something rare and I'm immediately making it available to everybody," a blend of competitive generosity and esoteric taste flaunting. Looking at today's urban landscape, I'm struck by how little has changed since the 1960s. This creates a peculiar emotion, nostalgia for the future, or neostalgia. While advances in medicine, telecommunications, and computing are impressive, they lack the visual grandeur previous generations anticipated. Instead of using technology for heroic endeavors like colonizing Mars, we document mundane lives on social media and indulge in pop culture nostalgia activities, suggesting a society losing its appetite for grand visions. Today, we struggle to envision the future except in cataclysmic terms: climate disasters, surveillance states, or corporate dystopias. The early 2000s saw a surprising revival of interest in modernist architecture, particularly brutalism with its bold concrete forms and utopian aspirations. This appreciation emerged alongside a fascination with mundane spaces like motorway service stations, physical reminders of more ambitious times. What happens to a counterculture when its artifacts are preserved not for their disruptive power, but for their historical significance? The answer may lie in how thoroughly we've domesticated yesterday's revolutionaries. Perhaps our current retromania is merely a phase, a necessary processing of our accumulated cultural history before moving forward again. Despite recognizing that linear progress might be an ideological construct misapplied from science to culture, I find it difficult to abandon looking toward tomorrow. The fundamental problem with musical innovation today isn't lack of talent or technology. It's that the landscape has grown too cluttered. Most musical styles and subcultures that have ever existed remain active, with nothing seeming to fade away, hampering the emergence of genuinely new forms. Yet history suggests cultural stagnation eventually gives way to revolutionary breakthroughs. The most vibrant artistic movements often emerge when they seem least likely, from unexpected places and unlikely combinations. Perhaps our cultural salvation lies not in more skillful recycling of the past, but in learning to forget, in creating spaces where new forms can emerge unencumbered by history's weight. The future isn't something we discover in archives, but something we create by leaving the familiar behind. Our digital culture landscape resembles a museum with exhibits from all time periods jumbled together with no chronological order, creating a paradoxical combination of rapid news turnover coexisting with persistent nostalgic content.